Yay, summer in the Psalms. It's finally here. Well, so happy to be with all of you. Thanks for coming. I would like to know if any of you came last summer to Summer in the Psalms. Anybody who came? A few. Okay, and did anyone come the summer before that? We actually had a Summer in the Psalms on the Plano campus. Anybody come to that one? Okay. All right, just checking. Okay, so very excited about the Psalms. And before we jump in, we're going to talk about something else that we all love, food. Okay, so one of the adventures of traveling to different countries is trying different food. But if you live in Dallas, you don't need to go to other countries to try different foods. So I Googled this and found that there are 80 different types of ethnic cuisine in Dallas. Now, not 80 restaurants, 80 different types of ethnic cuisine. But, okay, and so let me tell you just a couple of these. We got our regulars, but then we've also got Vietnamese, Lebanese, Peruvian, Salvadoran, Brazilian, Ethiopian, Pakistani, Cuban, Armenian, Russian. That's just 10 out of the 80. There's so much to explore in the area of food, but our default is to stick with the familiar. It's comfortable, we understand it, we know what to order. It's a safe option. The Psalms is a smorgasbord for hungry souls, and there's lots of variety, but our default is to stick with the familiar. We have our favorite Psalms, and we gravitate to those. The Psalms, some of the Psalms, are confusing. They are Hebrew poetry, and we don't understand Hebrew, the language, or the culture. And we don't always understand poetry. We read the Psalms through our 21st century lens, and we don't always make the connections. Psalms contains the history and culture of Israel, and some of that is unfamiliar to us. Now, one of my favorite examples is we read in the book of Psalms, Tabor and Hermon sing for joy at your name. But we don't know Tabor or Hermon, and in fact, they are both mountains. In Hebrew, the book of Psalms is called Tehillim, meaning praises. But not all the Psalms are praise songs. There are wisdom songs and warfare songs. There's messianic psalms, lament psalms, liturgical psalms, psalms of thanksgiving, and other types of psalms. Jesus said, "Everything written about me in the Psalms must be fulfilled." So there is camouflage truth in there just waiting to be uncovered. So let me tell you the goals that we have for this six-week Bible study on the Psalms. The first is that we want to expand your palate for the Psalms, to give you some new favorites, and then to revisit familiar ones with new insights. Okay, the second goal would be to broaden your approach to the Psalms, that you wouldn't just run to the Psalms for comfort, but you would run for wisdom and confidence and for forgiveness and restoration. Then, thirdly, we want to teach you a little bit about Hebrew poetry, because this is the key to understanding the book of Psalms. And then the last goal is just that you would gain a new appreciation for this ancient book that remains timeless. The Psalms is like no other book. Whereas the prophetic books are God's words to man, the Psalms are man's words to God. It is the human response to the divine encounter. In the book of Psalms, God's people are talking to God, and then they're talking to each other, sometimes in back and forth dialogue, and then sometimes right in the middle, God jumps in and speaks. Psalms run the gamut of human emotions, from ecstatic joy to immeasurable sadness, the weight of personal sin, and all the frailties of this temporary existence. Here's a quote from Donald Whitney. God has inspired a psalm for every sigh of the soul. Psalms give us words when we're searching, but no words come. When we don't know what to pray. When we need an emotional outlet in an upward direction. The book of Psalms was Israel's devotional guide. It was their prayer book. It was their hymnal. Now, it's safe to say that every devout Jew knew every psalm by heart. There's only 150 of them. Like, how many songs do you know? So the Psalms were written over a 900-year period. That's a long period of time. The first psalm was the Psalm of Moses, Psalm 90, in 1400 B.C. And then the last psalm that was written was Psalm 137 in 400 B.C. So you see, they were written over a very long period of time. Okay, who wrote the Psalms? Well, there's 150 Psalms. 73 were written by King David. So that's about half of the Psalms. Then 27 other Psalms were written by six other named authors. And then 50 Psalms are anonymous. We don't know who wrote them. What we know is that they were the songwriters and poets of their day. So we're going to talk about Hebrew poetry for about 6 minutes. Because understanding Hebrew poetry is the key to understanding the book of Psalms. In English poetry, there's usually rhyme or meter or both. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. Rhyme and meter. But Hebrew poetry does not have rhyme or meter. And that's a good thing because otherwise it would be totally lost in translation. Okay, what Hebrew poetry has is parallelism. Corresponding thoughts line by line. In English writing, we are trained to avoid redundancy. You do not say the same thing over and over and over. In Hebrew poetry, you do say the same thing over and over and over. Redundancy is intentional because they were an oral culture, and this was their way to understand and remember what they were being taught. So I'm going to give you a simplistic explanation, and if you have your handout that has the six boxes on it, okay, so get that out. Okay, do y'all have that? If not, there's some on the back table. Okay, it looks like this. Okay, so we're going to run through this. This is very simplistic, but each week I'm going to add just a little bit more. Okay, and you got to pay attention because I'm going to test you on these things. Okay, so the first type of parallelism is synonymous. With two lines of poetry, the second line repeats the idea of the first line using different words. Now, two lines, not two verses, okay? Two lines of poetry. Here's two examples. I pour out my complaint before him. Before him, I tell my trouble. So do you see he's saying the exact same thing, just using different words? Remember the days of old. Consider the generations long past. Same idea, different words. That's Hebrew poetry, and it's beautiful. Okay, the next type of parallelism, synthetic parallelism. With two lines of poetry, the second line adds to the idea of the first line with new information. I have hidden your word in my heart that I might not sin against you. So the second line tells why I've hidden your word in my heart. New information. Oh, how I love your law. I meditate on it all day long. The second line gives evidence of his love for the law of God. Okay? The third type of parallelism is antithetic parallelism. With two lines of poetry, the second line gives an opposing idea to the first line. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge, but the mouth of the fool gushes folly. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Opposing ideas line by line. Okay, now, here's your bonus. Four lines. His speech is smooth as butter, yet war is in his heart. His words are more soothing than oil, yet they are drawn swords. Now, if you look at line one and line three, those are synonymous. They're saying the same thing. His speech is smooth as butter. His words are more soothing than oil. Then if you look at lines two and four, yet war is in his heart, yet they are drawn swords. Those are synonymous. And lines two and four are antithetic to one and three. Okay? His speech is smooth as butter, yet war is in his heart. His words are more soothing than oil, yet they are drawn swords. Okay, so this is the technique and the beauty of the Psalms. Okay, the next thing is called an inclusio, and that is when the final line of a poem is the same as the first line of the poem. It's kind of like putting a circle around it. And it can either be synonymously or synthetically. Synonymously would be meaning the exact same. Psalm 8, the first line and the last line. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. Okay, so parallelism is verbal artistry expressed in corresponding ideas. A similar idea, an additional idea, or a contrasting idea. So that's the basics of Hebrew parallelism, okay? Now, the important thing is not that you're able to identify, okay, what kind of parallelism is it, but that you're able to recognize these are parallel ideas. Parallelism shows us that no line of a psalm stands alone. Every line relates to either the line before it, the line after it, or another line in the psalm. And that is the key to understanding any Hebrew poetry, which the book of Psalms is all Hebrew poetry. Now, I used to think that Psalms were just a bunch of random thoughts that someone got mad one day, wrote it all down on a scroll, and then it became a psalm. No. You can see from what we've just gone through that there's a skill to this and a structure. Okay. So we're going to begin our psalm study with a very unique psalm. Now, some of you have already read it, and you're like, I've never read this one in the Psalms. It's not your typical praise psalm. In fact, it's not a praise psalm. It's closer to what you would find in the book of Ecclesiastes. For the Old Testament saints, it paved the way for the gospel. And for us, it is a perfect segue to sharing the gospel. Okay, so when you're walking on the beach and you come across an elaborately built sandcastle that obviously took hours and hours to build, what's one of your first thoughts? Yeah, like too bad, when the tide comes in, it's all going to wash away. Now, some people think they can avoid this fate by building the sandcastle beyond the tide line. But the truth of it is, the shelf life of a sandcastle is very short. Sandcastles do not last. Similarly, every time you go to a funeral, it is a healthy reminder of the temporary nature of this life. Many will accomplish great things during their time here in this earthly kingdom, but it will all wash away when death brings in the tide. So how should this certainty, the certainty of death, how should this factor into the life that we live today? The theme for Psalm 49 is the certainty of death and the temporary nature of wealth and splendor. Psalm 49 does not have to be a downer. It is a wisdom psalm. The reminder of death is actually a gift. When you realize the limited time that you have here on earth and the few things that have lasting value, you will not invest in metaphorical sandcastles that will one day wash away. Psalm 49, hear this, all you peoples. Listen, all who live in this world. both low and high, rich and poor alike. My mouth will speak words of wisdom. The utterance from my heart will give understanding. I will turn my ear to a proverb. With the harp, I will expound my riddle. Why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches? No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough that he should live on forever and not see decay. For all can see that wise men die. The foolish and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. Their tombs will remain their houses forever, their dwellings for endless generations, though they had named lands after themselves. But man, despite his riches, does not endure. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the fate of those who trust in themselves and of their followers who approve their sayings. Like sheep, they are destined for the grave, and death will feed on them. The upright will rule over them in the morning. Their forms will decay in the grave, far from their princely mansions. But God will redeem my life from the grave. He will surely take me to himself. Do not be overawed when a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases, for he will take nothing with him when he dies. His splendor will not descend with him. Though while he lived, he counted himself blessed, and men praise you when you prosper. He will join the generation of his fathers who will never see the light of life. A man who has riches without understanding is like the beasts that perish. Okay, so definitely not a praise psalm. Psalm 49 is one of 11 wisdom psalms, and I wrote those on the back of your handout. What are the other wisdom psalms? Now, we have covered some of these in other summers. And what is it that makes a wisdom psalm? How is it identified? Well, there are certain repeated themes that you see in wisdom psalms. A contrast in people, the wise and the fool. A contrast in lifestyles, the way of the righteous and the way of the wicked. You see that in Psalm 1. Contrast in choices, trust the Lord or trust yourself. Wisdom psalms describe and prescribe the way to achieve the good life. Now, the wisdom presented in Psalm 49 is not telling us what we should do. It's telling us what attitude we should have. Because the certainty of death changes the meaning of life. So here's the structure of the psalm. Verses 1 through 4, listen up. Verses 5 through 12, don't be intimidated by those with temporary wealth. And 13 through 20, don't be impressed by those with fleeting splendor. Okay, verses 1 and 2. Hear this, all you peoples. Listen, all who live in this world, both low and high, rich and poor alike. Okay, look at lines 1 and 2 of verse 1. And tell me, what kind of parallelism is this? Synonymous. Okay, it's saying the exact same thing with different words. Hear this, all you people. Listen, all who live in this world. Same thing, different words. Okay, verse 2. Look at those two lines, both low and high, rich and poor alike. What kind of parallelism is that? It's synonymous with a crisscross, both low and high, rich and poor alike. The low are obviously the poor, the high are the rich, and then he just switched the order. Okay, so verses 1 and 2 are telling us who this psalm is for. Everyone in the world. Specifically calling attention to those of low and high social status. That would be the rich and the poor. The message is for two categories of people. For the first group, it will be an encouragement, and for the second group, it will be a warning. Verse 3, my mouth will speak words of wisdom. The utterance from my heart will give understanding. Okay, what kind of parallelism is this? Are these two lines? Synonymous. Okay, my mouth and my heart, one's giving wisdom, one's giving understanding. Those are intended to be similar. Okay, verse 3 is telling us why we should listen to what he's about to say, for wisdom and understanding. So verse 3 is synthetic to verses 1 and 2 because it's answering the question why. Why we should listen for wisdom and understanding. New information. Okay, verse 4. I will turn my ear to a proverb. With the harp, I will expound my riddle. What kind of parallelism is that? Okay, so this is synthetic because I'm going to listen to a proverb and now I'm going to tell it to you. Okay? So, this psalm, okay, so verse 4 tells us what we are about to hear in this psalm. We're about to hear a proverbial wisdom psalm. Now, a proverb is a short, pithy statement similar to what you see in the book of Proverbs. It's not intended to answer every question on a topic. It gives you one main point and then leaves the reader to ponder the implications. So this psalm is not going to address all the aspects of death and the afterlife. It will give you one point, death is certain, and then it will leave you to ponder the implications of that. Now, in this psalm, we also see a little cynicism and a little sarcasm. Okay, so verses 1 through 4 tell us who the psalm is addressed to, why we should listen, and what we're about to hear. Verses 5 through 12, don't be intimidated by those with temporary wealth. Verses 5 and 6. Why should I fear when evil days come, when wicked deceivers surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches? Okay, so we've got a four-line parallelism here. So look at lines 1 and 2. That would be verse 5. What kind of parallelism is that? See, you didn't know you were going to come and I was going to make you think after you've already been at work all day. All right, it's synthetic because line 2 clarifies what does he mean by evil days? When wicked deceivers surround me. And then lines 3 and 4 further clarify who are those wicked deceivers? Well, those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches. The question he's asking is in first person. Why should I fear? Because this is a song that you are supposed to sing. Now, it's a very strange song, but hey, we've got strange songs. So in this song, you ask yourself a question, then you tell yourself the answer. You are singing a proverb to yourself. Okay, verse 5 says evil days. Why should I fear when evil days come? Well, other translations for evil days would be times of trouble, days of adversity. There's two groups of people in this psalm, and the first group is introduced here, wicked deceivers. Those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches. Now, in this context, the wealthy unbelievers who have power to oppress everybody else, these are unbelievers. He's not talking about just rich people who love the Lord. He's talking about rich people who are unbelievers who oppress everybody else. Now, how do we know that? Because in verse 6, look and see, there's two words, trust and boast. Well, the word boast is actually the Hebrew word halal, which means praise. They trust and praise their own riches. They're not trusting and praising God. They're trusting and praising themselves. Okay, verse 5 also says, why should I fear? This is the fear of intimidation. Fear of wealthy oppressors who make life difficult. Now, this psalm is addressing a problem that is prevalent in most of the world for most of human history. The powerful wealthy oppress those who have neither power nor wealth. The rich rule over the poor and keep them so pressed down that they can't get up. When the United States was founded, it was known as a place where you could be free from an oppressive government. And you were not locked into your social status. The American dream is that any person can work hard and get ahead. And yet this is only partially true. Who are the influential people in positions of power? It's not the middle class. It's surely not the poor. It's the wealthy. The confident boasting of the wealthy is because they have a false sense of security and a perception of invincibility. But this psalm says, not so fast. Okay, verse 7 through 9. No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough that he should live on forever and not see decay. Verse 8, the word life is the Hebrew word nefesh, which means soul. The ransom for a soul is costly. Now, in 7 through 9, he's beginning to answer the question, why should I not be intimidated by the powerful wealthy? Because God is part of the equation. God has the power over life and death. What could you give to God in exchange for a soul? Jesus asked the same question. There's no amount of money. How much money could buy immortality? There'll never be enough. Wealth has critical limitations. Money can't ransom a soul. That's verse 8. And money can't prevent death and decay. That's verse 9. Their riches can't buy the most important things, immortality and a redeemed soul. So don't be intimidated by the powerful wealthy who oppress you. Remember that God can give you the true riches that money cannot buy. Verse 10, for all can see that wise men die. The foolish and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. He's continuing to answer the question, why should we not be intimidated by the powerful wealthy? Because everyone's going to die, the wise man and the fool, and no one gets to take their wealth with them when they die. Everyone leaves it all behind. The power and prestige that come from wealth is overinflated. It all ends at death. And unlike the predictable tides, we don't know when death will come. Verse 11, their tombs will remain their houses forever, their dwellings for endless generations, though they had named lands after themselves. Their tombs become the new home for their physical body. Wealth can buy a fancy mausoleum or a granite headstone, but wealth can't transport you to a better place. And then he adds a little sarcasm here. He says, though they named lands after themselves. Well, land with your name on it does not make it yours forever. And from the beginning of time, people have named lands and cities after themselves. It's their way of perpetuating their own memory. But let's put that to the test. Okay, so who can tell me here who is the William of Williamsburg? Okay, who can tell us who is the Charlotte of Charlottesville? Okay, how about the Scott of Scottsdale? Now, raise your hand if you care. That's the point exactly. No one knows and no one cares. So don't be going naming lands after yourself. Okay, verse 12. But man, despite his riches, does not endure. He is like the beasts that perish. Now, there are two refrains in this song. Verse 12 is the first refrain, and then it will be repeated in verse 20 with a slight change. Okay, the refrain restates the theme of the psalm, the certainty of death for all. All the money in the world won't give you an advantage over the animals. You share the same fate, death and decay. Now, I remind you that the psalmist's purpose is not to discuss all the aspects of the afterlife. He's simply stating the certainty of death for all creatures. Now, in Genesis, God gave humanity dominion over the animals. But in this one regard, man has no advantage over the beasts. All will die and decay. So, his point in 5 through 12, don't be intimidated by those with temporary wealth. They're not as powerful as they think they are. There's a time limit on their power and influence. It will eventually wash away like the tide. Death is more powerful than riches. Okay, so let me ask you, are you intimidated by wealthy people, by the power and influence they have over the rest of us? Me too. And why is that? Because somehow we think that they are superior because they have power and wealth. And we wish we had power and wealth. We've bought into their deception. Wealth in itself is not wrong, but wealth can tend to inflate your importance in your own eyes and in the eyes of other people. The Bible does not condemn wealth. What it condemns is the pompous attitude that often goes with wealth. In Dallas, we are surrounded by materialism everywhere, and it is easy to fall into the trap of being focused on things. Now, this psalm is a healthy reminder that our life in this earthly kingdom is temporary, and all our money and possessions are temporary. Okay, the final section of the psalm, 13 through 20. In the previous section, that one we just saw, 5 through 12, all people share a common experience, death. Now we will see in 13 through 20, all people do not share a common fate. Verse 13. This is the fate of those who trust in themselves and of their followers who approve their sayings. Now he adds to the description of the first group that was introduced in 5 through 12, wicked deceivers. These powerful wealthy trust in themselves. And then they have followers in their group. These are the wannabes. We have celebrity-obsessed followers today. There's nothing new. The appeal of power and popularity will always attract followers. This group trusts in themselves. They trust in their money, their influence, their power, presumptuous confidence for themselves and their followers. And then we see the Hebrew word at the end of verse 13, the Hebrew word selah. And that just means pause and think about this. It is like an instrumental interlude in a song. Like you sing a few words, then the instruments play, and then you sing a few more words. That's selah. Think about what you've just read. Okay, verse 14. Like sheep, they are destined for the grave, and death will feed on them. Okay, verses 14 and 15 have three mentions of the word grave. So if you're taking notes or whatever, just circle those. There's 2 in 14 and 1 in 15, grave. Now, this is not talking about the graveyard. This is the Hebrew word sheol. The Old Testament understanding of sheol is that sheol is the holding place for the dead. It is the realm of departed spirits. Now, in the New Testament, we have a more fuller understanding, but remember, Psalm 49 is Old Testament. In verse 14, death is personified as a shepherd who leads the sheep to the slaughterhouse, where death will feed on them and keep them in Sheol. Okay, now he introduces the second group of people, line 3 of verse 14, the upright. The upright will rule over them. In the morning, God will turn the tables on the powerful, wealthy who trust in themselves. In the morning, the upright will have dominion over them. In the morning symbolizes when the evil days are over. Remember verse 5, why should I fear evil days? Well, in the morning is a new era after those evil days, after death. And this is intended as a contrast to this life where the rich have dominion over the non-rich. Okay, now back to the powerful wealthy, line 4 of verse 14. Their forms will decay in the grave far from their princely mansions. So, more sarcasm here. Far from their princely mansions. Sheol is an ironic twist to the magnificent earthly estates that many wealthy live in. Now, they might be buried in graves close by, but Sheol is far away, so close, and yet so far. Verse 15, but God will redeem my life from the grave. The word life is the same life in verse 8, nephesh, soul. God will redeem my soul from Sheol. He will surely take me to himself. Now remember in 7 through 9, no person can ransom a soul. No money can redeem a soul. But God will redeem my soul from Sheol. This is the second mention of God. The first mention was verse 7. Without God, we all have the same fate. Death is powerful and all-consuming, but God is the powerful one who intervenes on behalf of the upright. God is the only one who can redeem a soul. And this psalm prepares the Old Testament saints for the gospel. Verse 15 is antithetic to verse 14. They will decay in the grave, but God will take me to himself. So, who is the my in verse 15? God will redeem my soul. It's the person singing the song. Presumably, the upright. The song was written for the whole world, but it's not the powerful wealthy who are singing it. Okay, the Old Testament Jews did not know how redemption would take place, but they knew that they had a Redeemer. What an incredible verse to share with a Jewish friend. Tell them about the Redeemer. The resurrection of the body was a mystery until the time of Jesus, and we now know that even our bodies will be resurrected, and that removes the sting of death. It does not remove death, but it does remove the sting of death. Okay, Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. So let's summarize the two kinds of people with different destinies. Those who trust in themselves, including their followers, those will lose everything, including their souls. And those who trust in the Lord, the upright, their souls will be redeemed by God, and God will take them to be with him forever. And then there's one more, Selah. Think about this contrast in people. Okay, verse 16 and 17. Do not be overawed when a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases, for he will take nothing with him when he dies. His splendor will not descend with him. Okay, so look at verse 16, those two lines, and tell me what kind of parallelism is that. Okay, synonymous. When a man grows rich, when the splendor of his house increases. Okay, those are synonymous. Okay, now what about 17? Those two lines. Haha, synonymous. They're saying the same thing. He will take nothing with him. His splendor won't go with him. Okay, so 16 is synonymous, 17 is synonymous, and 17 is synthetic to 16 because it tells us why we should not be impressed with the powerful wealthy. Okay? Now let's be honest, we are in awe of the rich and famous, celebrities from film and sports and British royalty, Princess Kate and Prince William and their darling offspring, and the popular group in high school. But why is that? It's our perception. Somehow we think that they are able to do things that we are not able to do. We think they're able to go places and buy things that we can't afford. We think that they just show up and their presence opens doors. Well, in some measure, that is the case. But this psalm reminds us that it is oh so temporary. Verse 17 answers the question in verse 5 and the command in verse 16. Don't be intimidated or overly impressed with the elaborate sandcastles that people are building. The tide will soon come in and wash them all away. Ecclesiastes reminds us, naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. My husband and I were at a restaurant, and Sitting next to us was a grandfather and his two grandkids, I'd say about 8 and 10 years old. So somewhere in the middle of the conversation, I heard the grandfather say, "Well, that reminds me of Elvis Presley." And the granddaughter said, "Who's that, Granddad?" And I thought, "Oh, Elvis, his splendor is fading." Okay, here's a good quote, Thomas Adams. "Rich men are like hailstones. They make a noise in the world as they rattle on the tiles of a house. Down they fall, lie still, and melt away." Verse 18 and 19, "Though while he lived, he counted himself blessed, and men praise you when you prosper, he will join the generation of his fathers who will never see the light of life." Okay, in line one of verse 18, it uses a reflexive verb, meaning literally, he blesses himself. This person congratulates themselves on their amazing life. The wealthy who live blessed lives often praise themselves, and other people praise them, which only feeds their false security. But they and their followers are deceived. All their prosperity and splendor will end at death. Now, the light of life that's in verse 19 refers to the same thing as the morning in verse 14, the new era of life beyond death. The light of life is the opposite of Sheol, which is the place of absolute darkness. So what is the point of verses 13 through 19? Don't be overly impressed by those with temporary splendor and their enthusiastic followers. Their splendor and influence will perish with them. Their elaborate sandcastles will wash away when death brings in the tide. Verse 20, "A man who has riches without understanding is like the beasts that perish." So this is the second refrain in the song. The first refrain was verse 12, which emphasizes the rich man's lack of longevity. He does not live forever. And verse 20 emphasizes the rich man's lack of understanding. The difference between humans and animals is the degree of understanding that humans have. But if a person has no understanding of the ways of God or recognizes their own mortality, then they are no different than the animals. They will live and die like the beasts that perish. Now, here's a quote from two commentators on Psalm 49. "The goal of this psalm is not that you would be poor in wealth, but that you would be rich in understanding, that you would not trust in riches that you have, nor envy riches that you do not have." Now, we usually think of the wealthy as those who have way more than we do. But the truth is, on a global scale, every single one of us in this room is wealthy. Psalm 49 is a proverbial wisdom psalm. It presents one main point and two application points and then leaves us to ponder the implications. The main point of this psalm: death comes to all people and you can't take wealth and splendor with you. That's the main point of Psalm 49. The two application points: don't be intimidated by those with temporary wealth and the power and prestige that come with it. And don't be overly impressed by those with fleeting splendor and the influence and applause that comes with it. Now, both of these applications deal with our attitude, not our actions. We are not told what we should do. We are told what attitude we should have. And why is that? Because this is a wisdom psalm, and wisdom tells us to work on your attitude, because your attitude will determine your actions. If we view our years in this earthly kingdom as temporary, and if we view any wealth and influence that we might have as temporary, then we will not spend our time building metaphorical sandcastles that are also temporary. We will invest our time in things that last. We will use our money and our influence for the eternal kingdom that will not wash away. Let's pray. Father, we are so indebted to you for your word. Lord, there's so much variety in your word. It is words that comfort us. It's also words that give us a good holy kick in the pants. Thank you for your word, Lord. Thank you for wisdom psalms. Thank you that you put everything we need in your word. Lord, we want to be wise. We want to live wise lives. And thank you for this reminder. We love you, Lord. We praise you in Jesus' holy name. Amen. Okay, so we're going to have discussion groups. But if you want to run down and get your ice cream, whatever, go down, get it, come back up, whatever. Okay.